calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
879 days, 12 hours, 52 minutes, 58 seconds until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves office, barring impeachment. Welcome back to our program. Our quote for the day from Franklin Roosevelt: a conservative is a man with two perfectly good legs who, however, has never learned how to walk forward. Coming up on today's program, David Sirota will be here on the topic, the louder they cry, the farther they know they're falling. And right now, David Horowitz is with us. David Horowitz, www.shadowparty.com, the website for his new book, The Shadow Party, How George Soros, Hillary Clinton, and 60s Radicals Seized Control of the Democratic Party. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. You're a good sport for having me on there twice.
Yeah. Well, you know, the last time we talked, it was when I was filling in for Randy Rhodes on her program. Mm-hmm. And basically our you're a good sport for coming on, by the way.
I enjoy the give and take.
Oh, good, good. It devolved into you and I, you're suggesting that Soros was, this kind of black hole conspiracy on the left, and my suggesting that the Scapes were a black hole conspiracy on the right that you were a part of, and you suggested, why don't we talk about the issues instead of going after people? And so I thought in this conversation, maybe we should talk about the issues.
All right.
You up for that?
I think that's a good idea.
Okay. In your book, you suggest that the Democratic Party is being, has become a cult. In fact, in your piece in today's Wall Street Journal, your letter to the editor, along with Richard Poe, your co-author, you say, has the Democratic Party become a cult? And, you want to bring it back to your book, but the issue of whether or not we're actually fighting a war on terror, I think, is an important issue for us to be discussing here in the United States. How do you fight a war on a tactic?
Well, I agree with that. What we're fighting is a religious war against Islamo-fascism, if you like, or Islamic Nazism, as I prefer.
Islamic theocracy?
Pardon?
How about Islamic theocrats?
Well, but they're Nazis. I mean, they want to exterminate the Jews. That's overt. They want to kill Americans. So death to America is their chant. But in any case, it is a religious war. And, it's odd that Bush has been so demonized by liberals and leftists because he's actually, more of a moderate. I mean, here he was trying to protect the sensibilities of Muslims and therefore referred to it as a war on terror. Soros wants to treat these terrorists as though they're part of individual criminal operations and just use a police methods to deal with them, which is very ostrich-like, don't you think? I mean, it's blinding yourself to the fact that these are very large organizations, that they're funded and organized by states like Iran.
Or Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia funded the Wahhabists.
No, you're absolutely right. Saudi Arabia is part of this, and this is also part of the forthright and strong position of the Bush administration.
Well, this is my concern, is that George W. Bush, by invading Iraq, and frankly, I would say to some extent, even by invading Afghanistan, when the Taliban offered to give us Osama bin Laden, Bush said, no, we don't want him. We'd rather bomb your country.
You think he would have gone right at Iran?
I beg your pardon?
You think we should have gone right at Iran?
No, I don't. I think that was you want a real mess. See,
well,
here's the fundamental issue, and that is, can you use military force to convince people that their thinking is wrong? And I just don't think you can.
We did it pretty successfully with the Germans and the Japanese.
The Germans and the Japanese were fighting us right up until the very last day of the war, when the Germans learned that Hitler was dead, and when the Japanese didn't stop fighting until Hirohito said stop.
Right, and dropping
we had to take out their leadership, and we had the ability. George Bush had the ability to take out the leadership of Al Qaeda right from the get-go.
No,
right after 9/11, the Taliban said, "We will give you Bin Laden," and Bush said, "No, thank you, I don't want him."
This is very odd conversation here, because the left is now defending Iran. I see Ray McGovern is out there, and Medea Benjamin are already forming the phalanxes around Iran. When I see leftists arguing for a prosecution of the war, not on terror,
but
on Islamic.
You're not addressing my point, David, and I think.
But you're not serious. Come on.
I'm trying to have an honest and serious conversation with you here about this. How can you bomb people into thinking that you're good guys?
Well, that's not the object.
Are you suggesting that we should?
You can't. That's not the object. The object is to bomb them into thinking, following the leadership of radical Islamicists is not a good idea. Following Hitler, following Tojo was not a good idea. And the Japanese got that idea, pretty heavily.
Hitler and Tojo were both engaged in aggressive wars. They were both reaching out and preemptively striking other nations.
Neither of them managed to blow up people in New York City. Now,
they blew up a hell of a lot of people in Hawaii.
It's a mistake. Yeah, that's true. But they did target a military installation. But that's true. That's what got us into that war, and that's what's gotten us into this one. It's a mistake.
No, my point is this is not a war.
Well,
this
Bill
is not
Clinton.
A war.
Let's go back to '93. The World Trade Center was bombed in '93 by the same.
And the guy who was behind it is rotting in jail right now because Bill Clinton tracked him down and put him in prison.
This wasn't a guy. This is the whole point.
The people behind it are in jail.
No, it's not just people. First of all, let's stop. Bill Clinton never visited the site. He diminished its importance, and as a result, we were attacked again and again, where he never did anything, and then we were attacked.
No, as a result of that, those people didn't get fed. Bin Laden was a small actor on the stage. He had 25,000 followers at the most. He wanted to be the Saladin of the world, and George Bush has made him that.
When you blow up two American embassies, which is an act of war, you are not a small player. And when you attempt to kill 250,000 people, which is what the first World Trade Center bombing was about, and another 100,000 in the aborted attempts to blow up the Lincoln and Holland tunnels. It's not small stuff.
These are not states coming after us, though. This was Bin Laden. This was an organization. You know, the Bonhoeffer gang.
The organization is called the Muslim Brotherhood. And it spawned Islamic Jihad and Egyptian Islamic Jihad and Palestine.
Oh, I know. It started with Qatar here in 1950 in the United States. You know, and then he went over to.
Pardon, I missed that.
It started with Qatar here in the United States in the 1940s, 1950s, and he went back to Egypt and said, you know, they're all, and you know, eventually tried to assassinate Anwar Sadat. Yeah.
And they did. They did assassinate Sadat.
Yeah, and they.
So
put
this
him
is a vast religious movement that's chief.
No, my point is it was a small religious movement until George Bush made it a vast religious movement, and your approach to this is going to make it an even bigger religious movement.
Tom, in 1979, there were 1 million people in the streets of Tehran. The American embassy had been taken hostage, and that was thanks to Jimmy Carter undermining the Shah.
No, that was thanks to the Shah being a repressive dictator.
You're so wrong about all that. The reason that they overthrew the Shah was because he liberated women. He was a dictator, and he did kill innocent people, but way less than the Ayatollahs did. But
the average person hated
him was because he liberated women. He took off the burqas.
But it wasn't the mullahs who overthrew the Shah. It was the people. The mullahs were the opportunists who were using that. And we handed it to them by supporting a guy who was a tyrant.
Nazism was a popular movement, and so was Islamofascism. And it was the Iranian Revolution. They had 1 million people in the streets chanting death to America. That was orchestrated. That has popular support.
And right after 9/11, you had 1 million people in the streets in Tehran holding candles in support of the United States.
That's exactly right. I never said that every Muslim in the world is a terrorist.
So why don't we work to change their minds by helping them wake up from the insanity of this rather than bombing them and further polarizing them?
It's really amazing. When you have people who think that if they kill enough children who are infidels, they're going to go to heaven, and if they're male, they're going to get 72 virgins.
But you think if you kill enough Iranian children, you're going to change the mind of Iran by bombing Iran. It didn't work in Iraq.
Let's take one small piece of the Nazi movement, the Palestinian Nazis. For 50 years, they've claimed they wanted land. The land was given. The appeasement was made. Give them back the land. Give them Gaza. So Gaza is now a giant terrorist base. Al-Qaeda is there. They've got new ones like Holy Islamic Jihad or whatever this new one is called. You can't, you have to defeat the terrorists. That's
Don't you get it, though, that Hamas is successful in the Palestinian territories because they're feeding people and building hospitals?
Great.
I mean, that's how you win hearts and minds. Why don't we do that instead of dropping bombs?
You're nuts. We finance Hamas. We finance all of that, welfare stuff. The United States and Israel are bigger...
David, we got to wrap it up. But I got your point. David Horowitz, his new book, The Shadow Party... ShadowParty.com, the website. George Soros, Hillary Clinton, the 60 radicals seize control of the Democratic Party. David, thanks for being with us.
Good conversation, Tom.
Indeed. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Thought they were pretty smart, but you got being right down to an art. You think you're a genius, you drive me up the wall. You're regular, original, know-it-all.
I think it's all that special, you know, this idea that we can just, like, bomb people into liking us. And if you really think that we're living in a day and age, particularly given that Pakistan now has nuclear weapons and it is inches away from being taken over by Islamists. I mean, General Musharraf is... Not literally hanging on by a thread, but he is holding power purely by military force. And if the military in Pakistan turns against him, which is a very real possibility, particularly if there's a conflict with India and he doesn't do what they want, or particularly if the Islamists can, you know, really whip them up, if the military turns against him, then it's going to be... I mean, you're worried about Iran having nuclear weapons right now? Pakistan has them. They have delivery systems for them. We have been supporting them in this. We're supporting India in building more nuclear weapons. This is the deal that George Bush just cut with them. Why can't we look at what Hezbollah has done in Lebanon and what Hamas did in Palestine and say, you know, maybe there is something to their strategy, and we should steal it. They go in and they say, we're your friends. We're going to build hospitals for you. We're going to build schools for you. We're going to make sure that you have enough food to eat. You know, we used to do this. Under the Roosevelt administration, under the Truman administration, under the Eisenhower administration, under the Kennedy administration, under the Johnson administration, under the Nixon administration, we used to do this. It wasn't until Reagan came under the Carter administration. It wasn't until Reagan came along and said, foreign aid stuff is for wimps. That's sissy stuff. Why are we? Look at all this money we're giving the UN. This is a waste of money. That's our taxpayers' money. You know, the rich folks in America, they need a tax cut. What are we going around the world trying to help people out? What are you? That's buying votes. That's what it is. It's buying votes. And the Democrats are doing that all the time. Social Security and Medicare. That's just buying votes. That's wrong. That was their argument. And let's say that it is buying votes. Might not it be a good idea? Shouldn't we be identifying moderate Muslim factors and factions in the Middle East and saying to them, we'll finance, you know, we will be your Iran, we will be your Syria, we will be your financier. By the way, right now, big debate going on inside the administration. Once again, the CIA, and this is such a repeat of what happened back in 1972, and I'm going to tell you the story about that. after the news at the bottom of the hour, the whole thing, and then we'll be taking your calls on this issue. But it is such a repeat of what Rumsfeld and Cheney did back in the 70s. Right now there is, and it is also a repeat of what happened just before the run-up to the Iraq War. Big debate going on inside the State Department and inside the administration, because the CIA is saying there is not a direct relationship between Iran and Hezbollah. Iran is not pulling the strings of Hezbollah. They may be sending them money, but they are not pulling the strings, and they are not involved in decision-making. And the administration wants to be able to say that they are, so that they can bomb Iran. These guys are, you know, so hungry for a war.
We've just got to have a war, you know, it's just got to have a war.
You will recall back in 1992, the Organization for the Liberation of Iraq, the group that started the Organization for the was founded by a vice president of one of the largest defense contractors in the United States. I mean, this is it, at the most cynical level, is it all about money? What else could it be? I mean, either that or there's a worldview at play here that is bizarre is the wrong word. That is so twisted up in the idea of violence that is, you know, a variation on Bush's idea that if he killed enough people in Texas, he could eliminate crime. And if he could just kill enough people in Iraq, he would eliminate terrorism. I'm sorry, you kill people, their relatives are upset with you. You feed people, their relatives are happy with you. You heal people. Kind of the advice that Jesus gave in the Bible. Maybe George W. and his friends should go back and read that. Or it's in the Old Testament as well. It's in the Quran. I mean, these are the memes that we need to be spreading around. But as Mark Mazzetti is writing in today's New York Times, some senior Bush administration officials and top Republican lawmakers are voicing anger that American spy agencies have not issued more ominous warnings about the threats they say Iran presents to the United States. Well, why? Because the CIA says they don't present a threat to the United States for all practical purposes. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you by, and to some extent you could say I am brought to you by, because I am thoroughly energized this morning as a result of Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. Great coffee. I haven't had coffee this good since I lived in Europe. This is really awesome stuff. 1-800-425-2532. Their telephone number, 1-800-425-2532, if you want to check out Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, also their website. And Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods now, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, smalldog.com. Welcome back to our program. Dr. Robert Pape wrote this book called Dying to Win, the Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. And some interesting points that he makes in the book. He says, and I'm quoting from his book, this is from page 4, he says, the data show that there is little connection between suicide terrorism and Islamic fundamentalism, or any of the world's religions. Rather, what nearly all suicide terrorist attacks have in common is a specific secular and strategic goal, to compel modern democracies to withdraw military forces from territory that the terrorists consider to be their homeland. You get this? He looked at a database of every suicide bombing and attack around the globe from 1980 through 2003. 315 attacks and all. This is from page 3. And on page 16, he says, as shown in Table 1, the explicitly anti-religious Tamil Tigers have committed 76 of the 315 suicide attacks, more than any group. He debunks the myth that suicide terrorists are wackos and insane people. He says, in general, suicide attackers are rarely socially isolated, clinically insane, or economically destitute individuals, but are most often educated, socially integrated, and highly capable people who could have who could be expected to have had a good future. They're generally better educated than average and are from working or middle classes. On page 216, he says, they resemble the kind of politically conscious individuals who might join a grassroots movement more than they do wayward adolescents or religious fanatics. So, you know, number one, it all has to do, so much of this has to do with the feeling of these guys are occupying our country, which is what bin Laden said to us back in 96 when he said he was going to attack us, that if we didn't get our troops out of Saudi Arabia, out of the bin Sultan Air Force Base there, where we put them in 1991 to use as a staging ground for the attack against Iraq in Kuwait, so that we could replace the regime of Saddam Hussein with the dictatorship of the inherited dictatorship, but friendly to us, of the Emir of Kuwait. He said, if you don't take those troops out of Saudi Arabia where they are defiling the Holy Land, I'm going to take you out. That was the basis of the whole thing. Well, how is this that history is repeating itself? Back in 1972, President Richard Nixon returned from the Soviet Union with a treaty worked out by Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. This was the beginning of a process that Kissinger referred to as detente. Remember this? On June 1st, 1972, Nixon gave a speech in which he said, and I quote, last Friday in Moscow, we witnessed the beginning of the end of that era which began in 1945. With this step, we have enhanced the security of both nations. We have begun to reduce the level of fear by reducing the causes of fear for our two peoples and for all peoples in the world. Richard Nixon, June 1st, 1972, declaring the era of fear was over because he had worked out detente with the Soviet Union. Now, that was intolerable to people who were making money on fear. Nixon left amid scandal, and Gerry Ford comes in, and Ford's Secretary of Defense and his Chief of Staff, Secretary of Defense, a guy by the name of Don Rumsfeld, Gerry Ford's Chief of Staff, a guy by the name of Dick Cheney, believed just right up front it was intolerable that Americans might no longer be bound by fear. Without fear, how could they be manipulated? Rumsfeld and Cheney began a concerted effort, first secretly and then openly, to undermine Nixon's treaty for peace and to rebuild the state of fear and thus reinstate the Cold War. These two men, 1974 Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld and Ford, Gerry Ford Chief of Staff Dick Cheney, did this by claiming that the Soviets had secret weapons of mass destruction that even the president didn't know about, that the CIA didn't know about, that nobody but them knew about. And they said because of these secret weapons of mass destruction that the Soviet Union had in 1974, the U.S. must redirect billions of dollars away from domestic programs that Richard Nixon had actually put in place, and instead give the money to defense contractors for whom these two men would one day work. As Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld explained to the United States in 1976, the Soviet Union has been busy. They've been busy in terms of their level of effort. They've been busy in terms of the actual weapons they've been producing. They've been busy in terms of expanding production rate. They've been busy in terms of expanding their institutional capacity to produce additional weapons at additional rates. They've been busy in terms of expanding their capability to increasingly improve the sophistication of those weapons. Year after year after year, they've been demonstrating that they have steadiness of purpose. They're purposeful about what they're doing. End of quote. The CIA strongly disagreed. They called Rumsfeld's position a complete fiction. They pointed out that the Soviet Union was, at that time, in 1974, in the process of disintegrating from within. They were barely able to feed their own people, and within a couple of decades, if you simply left the Soviet Union alone, it would collapse under its own weight. But Rumsfeld and Cheney wanted Americans to believe there was something nefarious going on, something we should be very afraid of. And so they created a commission. And they put their old friend Paul Wolfowitz in charge of it. It was called Team B. And sure enough, Wolfowitz's group, Team B, came to the conclusion that the Soviets had developed several terrifying new weapons of mass destruction, featuring a nuclear-armed submarine fleet that used a sonar system that didn't depend on sound and was therefore undetectable with our current technology. Now, back in 1977, when they were promoting this myth as a way of amping up defense spending, Dr. Ann Kahn, who was the head of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency at that time, 1977, said, and I quote, "They couldn't say that the Soviets had acoustic means of picking up American submarines because they couldn't find it. So they said, well, maybe they have a non-acoustic means of making our submarine fleet vulnerable. But there was no evidence they had a non-acoustic system. They're saying, we can't find evidence that they're doing it the way everyone thinks they're doing it, so they must be doing it a different way. We don't know what that different way is, but they must be doing it, even though there's no evidence." They said it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, it just means we haven't found it. End of quote. The BBC did a documentary on this. It's called The Power of Nightmares. Adam Curtis. And the documentary says, what Team B accused the CIA of missing was a hidden and sinister reality in the Soviet Union. Not only were there many secret weapons the CIA hadn't found, but the CIA was wrong about many of those they could observe, such as the Soviet air defenses. Now, the CIA were convinced that these were in a state of collapse, reflecting the growing economic chaos in the Soviet Union. But Team B, Paul Wolfowitz's commission, working with Rumsfeld and Cheney out of the Ford White House, Team B said that this was actually a cunning deception by the Soviet regime. They were just pretending to be in economic distress. The air defense system worked perfectly. Was there evidence? No. The only evidence they could produce to prove this was the official Soviet training manual, which proudly asserted that their air defense system was fully integrated and functioned flawlessly. The CIA looked at this and said, you guys, Wolfowitz, you're in a fantasy world. But as Melvin Goodman, the head of the CIA's Office of Soviet Affairs in 1976, from 76 all the way through 87, told the BBC, quote, Rumsfeld won that very intense political battle that was waged in Washington in 1975 and 1976. Now, as part of that battle, Rumsfeld and others, people such as Paul Wolfowitz, wanted to get into the CIA, and their mission was to create a much more severe view of the Soviet Union, Soviet intentions, Soviet views about fighting and winning a nuclear war. We have seen this movie before. I would submit to you that what these guys are doing in amping up a war in Iran is the same thing that they were doing in the 1970s with regard to the Soviet Union, trying to terrify us so that the defense industry can make billions, trillions. And now they've got Chris Matthews on their side. Here he is. He's saying the conservatives, yeah, they're right about this stuff. You know,
I keep hearing from people on the right, Robert Kagan and Bill Kristol, the guys who are most hawkish and most articulate in making their case, and they may be right.
They may be right.
That if at the end of this administration, this hawkish administration that was willing to go into Iraq and Afghanistan, if this president's not willing to knock out those facilities, no future president's likely to do it, we'll be stuck with a nuclear-armed Iran, which can rant and rave around that region, threatening Israel, Saudi, and everybody else, and we'll be stuck with it. So their argument is, try the diplomatic route, try everything, but in the end, we have to hit them.
Yeah, maybe just before the 2006 elections, or maybe just before the 2008 elections, if the Democrats don't take the House and Senate in 2006. We got to hit them. How to Win Hearts and Minds, 101. We'll be back with your calls after this break. It's 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, and the place where smart people get their news.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
This world.
And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People of the United States of America. And really, I would say the people of the world. You know, peace benefits everybody. War benefits, you know, a few people who make a fortune selling the instruments of war, and that's about it. Gary in Lincoln, Nebraska. Hey, Gary, thanks for calling the program. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, I'd like to go back to what you said a little bit ago about the suicide bombers and a little bit of their ideas and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there's a real similarity, maybe, possibly, between them and what people in this country look at as manic depressive people or people that are suffering with depression.
No, that's the mistake that we make, is thinking that, Gary. I think a better analogy is is between them and the guys who would charge into battle knowing that it was a lost cause. I mean, look at the battles of the Civil War, the battles of World War I, battles of World War II, where people went into these horrible battles knowing that their platoon or their group was going to take 30, 40, 50, 60, 70% casualties, and yet they, you know, and many of them were going to die, and yet they did it anyway.
Yeah, you know, I think it can be either way. I used to experience a lot of depression, kind of got treated for it and working with it and just recognize it. But I can very easily empathize with their feelings when it's almost like being in a straitjacket, knowing that there's a better way of doing things,
yeah.
But the frustration of not knowing how to get it done and having to live with what you have drives you almost to say, maybe is this the possibility that this could bring about a change? If it is, I'll sacrifice myself.
All right. Yeah. It's a tough one. Gary, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah, good talking with you. I need to ask the folks in New York to do the call screening here at the moment because my internet connection has gone fluey. But let's go to Kelly in Springfield, Missouri. Hey, Kelly, what's up? If Lauren, if you can put Kelly. Kelly, you're live and on the air?
No, hey, Kelly. How are you?
Hey, Kelly.
Hey, I was listening to that Mr. Horwitz guy earlier, and
yeah.
Very scary individual, because if you really look at what a cult really is, isn't it a small percentage of people with a bad idea and full of propaganda and fear? And isn't that what we're seeing from the Republican Party right now?
Well, I would certainly make that case, yes.
I mean, if you want to say cults, there's a cult for you. And the other thing is, this criteria for attacking a country is based on the fact of what happened 9/11. I mean, that's the biggest amount of bull I've ever heard, because if the criteria is 9/11, then we should be attacking Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and every single other country that was organized.
And the Pakistani intelligence service.
Exactly.
Which wired $100,000 to Mohammed Atta a week before 9/11. I mean, yeah, it's excellent point. I mean, we are so out in outer space on this thing. Kelly, thanks a lot for the call. Good point. Gene in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Gene, what's up? Oh, here, I'll push the button there. Gene, you're live and on the air.
To get right to the point, I want to ask you, when was George Bush Sr. the head of the CIA?
77 and 76, right around the time that Rumsfeld and Cheney were amping up the terror alerts against the Soviet Union.
Thank you for answering my question, Tom.
Yeah.
Thank you.
In fact, some would say that he was put into that position in part because of Rumsfeld and Cheney and the whole, you know, let's scare the hell out of people.
I knew there
bunch.
Had to be a connection there. I knew the time frame was too close.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot, Gene. Larry in Seattle. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom. Picked up my News Tribune this morning, and an insert fell out from the Washington State Department of Health on bird flu. I scanned it and sent you a PDF copy by email. It's a 6-page, really well-done brochure, and it lists all sorts of things of what to do and what is pandemic and why we should be afraid. I decided that I'd do a little search on the internet to see exactly why this might have come out at this particular time, other than it just getting into the influenza season. And one of the statements made by the Secretary of Health in the brochure is somewhat alarming. It says, most of us are familiar with the influenza or the flu, but there's another type of flu as well. It begins in birds or animals and then passes to humans. It has the potential to make millions sick in our country, around the world, and could be far more deadly than the seasonal flu. And it's not till you get down to the bottom of the page that you finally read that avian influenza cannot be spread from person to person. So unless you read the whole thing, you suddenly think that, oh my, there's something out there that can be passed from animals.
Well, the concern is that this flu might mutate. And
exactly.
And actually, what happened in 1917 or whatever the year was, 1918, I guess.
Right. Yeah, I was looking on the internet to see what's going on, and back 2 weeks ago, there's a story in the PI, the Post Intelligencer out of Seattle, that there's a testing being done of the migratory fowl up on Burr Island, which is in Skagit County, just north of us. And we get quite a bit of snow geese and mallards and whatnot coming over from Asia, and they're testing for the H5N1.
Yeah, they're doing it here in Portland, too.
Right, and they haven't found any yet. But,
no.
There's another piece of news that came out today from London. In Nature magazine, 70 scientists have signed up to start a creation of a new database to share bird flu data. So,
see, I don't see that as I see that as the kind of stuff that could be used to terrorize us. But I don't think that, you know, sharing public health information is necessarily part of a plot to terrorize Americans, because, you know, millions of people do die from the flu every year around the world. And if this flu does mutate and go weird, a lot of people could die. So,
right, we need to know everything we can about it.
I think so, yeah, I do, Larry. And I just don't see that as part of the whole, you know, be afraid, be very afraid thing that's going on. Although it certainly has the potential in the hands of the Bush administration to become part of it. And it's really how you handle these kinds of things. And that's one of the things that concerns me, frankly. Coming up in the next hour, David Sirota is going to be with us. And Hong Tran in the third hour of our program, 57 minutes past
the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. David Thiebaud, who is a regular conservative on our program, a guy that was coming on regularly from CNSNews.com and mixing it up with me. And I always respected David because he was always willing to come on and defend his positions, even though I disagreed with him. Has been diagnosed with a leukemia that he has a 45% chance of surviving. So he's doing chemotherapy here on this. This is the second time he's had cancer, and it's apparently in fact the result of the radiation therapy he had from a previous cancer. And I wanted to thank many of our listeners who, you know, I mentioned this when we first learned about it a couple of weeks ago, who went over to the conservative cybercast news service, CNSNews.com, and sent him a get well soon note. You know, we may not agree with you politically, but we're all humans here. And just wanted to thank those folks, because I've heard back from the folks with David that, you know, he got those notes and he appreciated them. David, another David, David Sirota is with us. He is the author of a new book, Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How to Take It Back, or How We Take It Back, at davidsirota.com, his website. And David, well, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I am so pleased you're out there. You know, I just have to say, you are such an eloquent and rational voice, and one of the few who's able to actually take on the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, and take them on in a meaningful way and do it on the issues. Ed Kilgore and the DLC are just freaking out about you.
Yeah, well, that's fine. The louder they they complain, the more I think that they realize their own increasing irrelevance.
Well, we're seeing now a full press court by some of these guys, Evan Bayh and whatnot, out there. Rahm Emanuel, he's got a new book out promoting their view of how the Democratic Party should be. Give us the back of the envelope version of how the DLC came about, what they're all about, and why they present a threat to the United States.
The DLC was founded in the mid '80s, essentially to. It started out as a group that was designed to, I guess, move the Democratic Party to the right on cultural issues. So a lot of the proposals that Bill Clinton enacted or pushed when he was president and on his campaign about, you know, the school uniform stuff, the V-chip stuff, that came out of the DLC.
And welfare as we know it.
Yeah, exactly, right. Yeah. And but what ended up happening was the DLC sort of metastasized into essentially a corporate front group that billed itself as Democrats. So it went from focusing on cultural issues to a group that started taking huge contributions from the likes of, you know, AT&T, Enron, DuPont, various huge companies. And essentially what that has meant is that it has started focusing for the last 10 years on pushing the Democratic Party to embrace corporate America's agenda. And what they've been very successful in doing in the 90s was getting a good faction of Democratic lawmakers to essentially go along with the Republican Party's economic agenda. So you see the DLC pushing these trade deals that have no labor, human rights, or environmental standards. You see the DLC issuing policy papers saying that Social Security privatization is a concept that that Democrats should look at. And again, they've been influential. You know, Joe Lieberman was the chairman of the DLC and was one of the first Democrats to give credence to the idea of privatizing Social Security. And so they have been a very destructive force within the Democratic Party.
Now, would it be safe to say, because this was my understanding, maybe I missed it, would it be safe to say that when Bill Clinton was running for president, that because Ronald Reagan had declared war on organized labor in 1981, at that point in time, about a quarter of our workforce in the United States was unionized. Unions had a lot of money and a fair amount of political power as a consequence of it. By the time 1990 came along and Bill Clinton was running for president, the unions were on the ropes. Reagan had beat them up quite badly, and Bush Sr. And so Clinton's looking around, how do we get cash? And,
right.
We can't get it from the unions, so let's go to the corporations. And the DLC was the vehicle to do that.
That's exactly right. But let's remember something. You know, there's been a lot of sort of historical revisionism that Clinton supposedly, the DLC's version is that Clinton supposedly ran on themes that didn't essentially go after, you know, corporate power. The fact is that's not true. If you look at Clinton's major speeches in 1992, he ran as an economic populist, and that's why he won. The DLC would like us to believe that the only way to win elections, the only way for Democrats to win elections, is to emulate this false version of how Bill Clinton won. Their false storyline is that Bill Clinton ran by trying to appease big money and trying to run to the so-called center, and I call it that because it's not really the center.
It's really not the center, it's the right.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the right.
To the right. And that's just not borne out by the facts. And look, you know, the DLC, I think, now realizes that people have had enough. You know, you see the Ned Lamont victory in Connecticut. You saw John Tester win the primary against the DLC candidate out here in Montana. And I think that the DLC is finally seeing that people, ordinary people, grassroots power is finally on a resurgence, and it's making them very, very nervous. They have gotten used to being able to call the shots within the Democratic Party, and I think that they see that time is ending.
Now, two questions. First, when did Clinton, where did he go wrong? I mean, in the original election of 92, he was not running as a corporate guy. When did he start embracing things like NAFTA and GATT? And secondly, one of the more cogent observations of power is that power does not release its hands lightly from the instruments of its power. What will the DLC do to maintain their, or what are they doing to try and maintain their power, and how far will they go?
Well, the first question is the answer to the first question is that almost the moment Bill Clinton got in office, which is very disappointing to a lot of us. I mean, here was a guy who gave a speech, for instance, a big economic speech, saying that he would refuse to sign or push any trade deals that didn't have labor and environmental protections. He specifically said he would not sign a free trade deal with China until that country cleaned up its human rights record.
This was in '92.
In '92, right. He then, you know, turned around and immediately pushed NAFTA over the objections of most Democrats in Congress, although some DLC Democrats agree with him. And you know, he was the guy who pushed through the China free trade deal, even though China didn't clean up its record and even though the trade deal itself didn't have any labor, environmental, or human rights protections. Now, how is the DLC gonna fight this? Well, look, we've seen it. We've seen what they do after the 2000 election, or after the Democratic convention in 2000, when Al Gore gave a quite a populist speech. The DLC came out and attacked him, and after he lost, they attacked him. They attacked him even though he had been a member of the DLC early on. And during the 2004 presidential primaries, the DLC publicly and viciously attacked Howard Dean, helping to destroy his candidacy. And so I think that what we can expect to see is that come after this upcoming congressional election, depending on what happens, either the DLC will blame the Democrats' loss on progressive populist Democrats, or if the Democrats win, the DLC will be working very feverishly behind the scenes to try to make sure that the party in the power that it controls doesn't use that power to actually push populist policies. And then, of course, when the 2008 presidential campaign comes along, you can expect the DLC to go after progressives like Russ Feingold, any progressive candidate, really.
Yeah, we have just a minute left. We're talking with David Sirota, davidsirota.com. The website, his new book, Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How We Can Take It Back. David, to what extent is the DLC inextricably intertwined with the Democratic Party versus intertwined with corporate America? I guess the subtext of that question is it possible for us to infiltrate and take over the DLC the way many of us are arguing we should do with the Democratic Party, or is it a lost cause?
No, look, the DLC is not a small-D Democratic organization. You know, you can infiltrate small-D Democratic organizations, that is, organizations that are open to people. You know, as I noted,
like the Democratic Party.
Exactly, the Democratic Party. I mean, as I noted on my website, you know, the DLC recently had its quote-unquote national conversation, which purports to be a gathering to talk about the direction of the organization and the direction of the country. Meanwhile, they had it in Denver, the Rocky Mountain News noted the meeting was closed to the public. So this is not an organization that is.
So the DLC is run like the Bush administration.
That's exactly right. It's a corporation.
Yeah, amazing. And you can read all about it over at davidsirota.com. David Sirota, his new book, Hostile Takeover. David, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And for the great work you're doing. Keep it up. I love reading your stuff. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least a clean election every now and then. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Everybody's talking, no one says a word. Everybody's making love, no one really cares. There's nasties in the bathroom, just below the stairs. Always something happening, nothing going on. There's always something cooking, nothing in the pot. They're starving back in China. So finish what you got.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, their website. Good morning, Ellen, or afternoon, wherever you may be.
Good morning, good afternoon. Calling you from Mississippi.
Oh, my goodness.
President is due here on Monday and then New Orleans on Tuesday. Congressional delegation, Democrats are coming down here on Monday and New Orleans Tuesday, leave New Orleans on Wednesday.
Wait a minute, so the Democrats are stalking the president?
They're stalking the president, you got it.
Good on them.
20 of them coming down.
Holy cow. I don't understand how he's going to be able to go down there and walk around the debris and turn that into a positive. I mean, this I'm reading in the press.
You know, the White House today issued a statement of the progress they made since Katrina. And, I mean, they talk about how the president's been down here 12 times, the first lady's been down here 13 times, cabinet officers, I think they said 82 or 84 times combined. Then they talk about all this money. And I'm actually down here with my niece and her husband and my brother, who is not, none of them have been down here, and we're just riding in from the airport, and they're just, their mouths are open, saying, how does this area even come back? And why hasn't there been more done? And then they came and they see these homes for sale, you know, the prefab homes, and I explained to them that a prefab home costs $45,000 to $50,000. But by the time they deliver a FEMA trailer, take it away, hook it up, take it back to where it is, do all the administrations, the average FEMA trailer is $75,000. Why not just give people the money to put a home on their property?
Well, because then you wouldn't have Halliburton in the middle.
Right.
I mean, right now...
It wasn't Halliburton. I told you who it was. Who's the other big contractor?
Bechtel. Bechtel.
Bechtel. Yeah. It's Bechtel that's making the money on this. Remember, I got taken off a FEMA Bechtel lot.
Yeah, and you'll recall that Caspar Weinberger and George Shultz of the Nixon administration were the president and vice president, respectively, of Bechtel way back when.
Right. So,
they've had their fingers in...
It's clearly an inside job.
Yeah, and Bechtel is one of the largest companies in America. It's just privately owned. It's not publicly traded, so not a lot is known about it. Stephen Bechtel is a pretty secretive guy. I'm curious, in southern Lebanon right now, Hezbollah is already rebuilding people's houses. And yet, here a year later, in our own country, we still have people who I think now, I mean, people didn't want to call them refugees back at the very beginning, but here a year later, it's sure starting to look like we've created refugees, internal refugees inside our country. What is, I mean, this is what happens when you have a government that doesn't believe in governance, and they don't know how to govern. What can be done, Ellen Ratner, and what are the Democrats, for example, suggesting?
Well, the Democrats are trying to do housing bills, but they haven't been successful in it because it's been stopped. I mean, the Black Caucus came up with a whole plan, and basically they were laughed out of Congress.
Because they don't control
because
the majority.
The administration did not want to do anything to really do the rebuilding the way it needs to be done down here.
Yeah.
I mean, I got to tell you, the one person who has been pretty good and who's really... I mean, he's kind of acted like a dictator, but he's gotten, if you really go down to New Orleans and Louisiana, and I'm not even talking about Ward 9, I'm just talking about Louisiana, and you look at Mississippi did a lot better because Haley Barbour just acted like a dictator and actually governed. I mean, for whatever you can say about Haley Barbour's other politics, he managed to get some recovery and some cleanup, which has not happened in parts of Louisiana.
Was Haley Barbour
part of that? A lot of people, yeah, he is. But
yeah.
Part of people say it's because he was able to, because he used to be chairman of the RNC. He basically strong-armed the Bush administration into providing, some funds and some governance.
Well, what do you think of the conspiracy theory that this is a plot to flip Louisiana from being a blue state to a red state? And, you know, they're going to help out Mississippi and they're not going to help out Louisiana until the people get enough sense to start electing Republicans.
Well, I think that there is something to be said for that, but there's a lot more to be said for the fact that truly, even though I don't like to say it because she's a Democrat, the governor of Louisiana just doesn't know how to govern terribly well, and she really has not used whatever clout she's had, locally or nationally, to get done what needed to be done. And that's, I mean, she just, frankly, I mean, and she also, she's so weak, you know, she's signing that abortion a bill to allow no more abortions in Louisiana if it becomes illegal or if they overturn Roe v. Wade. Louisiana is going to be the first state to not have abortions available.
This is Mary Landrieu's
sign? And this is the governor, I forget her name, but she's the female governor here.
Blanco, Kathleen Blanco, that's right.
Right. Who's a female, who's a Democrat, and she's looking like a Republican.
Amazing. Amazing. That's a sad story. Ellen Ratner from the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
You're welcome.
Have a great day. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change. 27 minutes right after.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Get alive, get a grip, get away somewhere, take a trip, take a break, take control, take advice from someone you know. Oh, come on over, come on in, pull up the seat, take a load off your feet, come on over.
And welcome back, helping you win the water cooler wars with Uncommon Sense from the Radical Middle. Tom Hartman here with you. Furious at Iran's decision to test fire surface-to-surface missiles and push forward with its nuclear program, President George W. Bush today named Iran to a newly formed Axis of Eviler. This is from Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. The president said he had invented the new Axis specifically for Iran because, to quote the president, evil does not describe just how evil these folks really are. Mr. Bush singled out Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad for special condemnation, calling the provocative head of state an evil doer, an eviler doer. The president said at first he was not sure whether eviler or eviler doer were actually words, but then he says, I checked with Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld, who assured me that they were. While the promotion of Iran from Axis of Evil to Axis of Eviler drew no initial response from President Ahmadinejad, it sparked an angry reaction from North Korean President Kim Jong-il, who said today, North Korea will not sit idly by and allow another nation to be called eviler than it. President Kim said he would double the number of missile tests it conducts and ramp up its uranium enrichment program in the hopes of being named to what he called the Axis of Evilist. In Washington, reporters asked Mr. Bush if he had unintentionally ignited a competition between Iran and North Korea to see which nation could do eviler things. Mr. Bush responded, mission accomplished. Elsewhere, after it was reported that JonBenet Ramsey murder suspect John Mark Carr was flown first class and dined on fried prawns and champagne, over 100 people came forward to confess to the crime. Indeed. Thank you, Andy Borowitz. BorowitzReport.com. On a more serious note, here's a pop quiz. Who founded the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq? A, a prominent Iraqi political exile, Ahmed Chalabi. B, Bruce Jackson, former Vice President of Lockheed Martin. Or C, neoconservatives William Kristol and Paul Wolfowitz. Who founded the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq? This is the group that ultimately led us into the war in Iraq. A, prominent Iraqi political exile Ahmed Chalabi. B, Bruce Jackson, former Lockheed Martin vice president. C, neoconservative William Kristol and Paul Wolfowitz. This from Gary Ferdman and Miriam Medzian. It was published in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer yesterday. The answer to who founded the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq? Bruce Jackson, former Lockheed Martin vice president. B. Gary and Miriam note, what does this mean? To understand, they say, our nation's foreign policy, including military interventions, follow the money. They say this should come as no surprise. Our country's built on the profit motive. We proved its effectiveness by outlasting the Soviet Union. While Americans understand that making money motivates McDonald's or Walmart, and some are concerned about business donating large sums to influence politicians, most are unaware of how the profit motive helps shape U.S. foreign policy. This is caused in part, they say, by our leaders draping decisions, especially wars, in patriotism. Take Iraq. President Bush leads Americans to believe that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11, had weapons of mass destruction, and threatens our national security. Once he invades Iraq, any question is portrayed as endangering our troops and homeland. By the time most Americans realize none of it's true, thousands of young soldiers are killed or maimed, hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayer dollars are flowing to often incompetent but politically connected Pentagon contractors. They note, for most decent, caring Americans, it's almost unthinkable that the profit motive played a significant role in putting our soldiers in harm's way. It's painful to acknowledge that we've been lied to and to ask why. Why was this war started? What role did our president and vice president and secretary of state's close ties to the oil industry play? Which powerful American companies stood to profit? And then Gary Feldman and Miriam Medzian go on to say, Bruce Jackson founded the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq in 2002, a few months after retiring from Lockheed Martin. In 2001, he and other members of the neocon Project for a New American Century wrote to President Bush stating that, quote, American forces must be prepared to back up our commitments to the Iraqi opposition by all necessary means. A year later, Jackson had chaired the subcommittee that produced the Republican Party's foreign policy plank that George Bush ran on in 2000. War profiteers or patriots? You decide. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Bill in Sacramento, California, KSAC.
Hi, how you doing?
Hey, Bill. I'm great. What's up?
Oh, you. I'm really glad that you're on this topic because this is really powerful stuff. I sent you an email some time ago, but you probably didn't get it. Probably got screened out. But this guy that you just mentioned is behind and closely tied to the Carlyle Group, and all of them are working with this group called New Bridge Strategies, which is Joe Albaugh,
mm-hmm.
and the now governor of Mississippi used to be part of that group. They were all formed to take advantage of any disasters, natural or by war, and he's behind Joe Albaugh. New Bridge Strategies is behind.
Wasn't Joe Albaugh the head of FEMA at one point?
He was part of FEMA, and he was the campaign director for Bush Jr. when he went in 2000.
Right.
This group was put together sometime in the mid 90s. This guy Bolton, who's like I said, whose father was the policy director for the CIA under Bush Sr.
You're talking about Josh Bolton?
Joshua Bolton, yeah.
Yeah. He's now the president's chief of staff.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. This guy's been behind the scenes and pulling the strings for a long time.
Yeah.
He's part of, if you want to do a search and get some specific information, you can call up, let's see.
No, there's no shortage of information about
yeah.
these guys.
I sent you this. It was on Right Watch. And if you put Bolton and New Project for New American Century and all that stuff together, it'll come up.
Yeah, we have reported on much of this before.
And minister without portfolio is the way to get information on Bruce Jackson. He's been in behind the scenes pulling the strings for NATO to be armed and was controlling who was going to get into NATO from Europe, the new expanded NATO.
Right.
If the only way they could get the arms and get the support was that they had to back up this Iraq adventure.
Interesting.
And
Bill, thanks a lot for the tip. I appreciate it and for the information. We have to just look at this stuff. We can't shrink from it. Bradley in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Bradley.
Hi, Tom. First time caller. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for calling. What's up?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to bring something to not only your attention, but to your listeners' attention that I have never heard, not only on your show, but on all the other talk radio shows out there on the progressive side. And that is that I'm a small business owner with 15 employees. And I wanted to bring to all of your attention the single greatest issue facing business owners. And that is, I'm a building contractor, and two-thirds of my competitors do not pay workman's comp. And if
Because they're hiring illegals?
No. That's the perception that people have. If you're not paying workman's comp, then you're also paying under the table. They go hand in hand.
Right.
And the price difference between myself and my competitors' bids will be 30 to 40% discrepancy. Hmm. And most of these folks that are...
But there's very strong laws, Bradley, to enforce that. I mean, I'm an employer, and I have been an employer for most of the last 30 years. And there's some pretty draconian laws about not paying workman's comp. Why don't you just turn your competitors in?
Well, because you fear for your own safety. That's what it comes down to.
Well, you turn them in anonymously. I mean, it's if people are breaking the law, let somebody know about it. I mean, there's serious fines for that. And
absolutely. I'm very, very aware of it, and so are these people. For example, the Lane County Home Builders Association, it's kind of a good old boys network. And I was asked to join it, and I told the vice president straight up, I said, you don't want me joining your group because I know you're just full of illegal contractors.
Yeah.
And he's, no, we're going to get on top of this. And so,
well, why don't you join their group and try and take it over and try and help these guys conform with the law?
You can. It's a good old boys network. I've already tried.
Well, become one of the good old boys.
You get pushed right out.
Yeah.
And I actually, when they had me join them for lunch, I brought one of my state senators along, and so he's in on the loop.
Yeah.
And so I called him on one of these contractors, and he called that contractor up and told him to come in Friday and show him his workman's comp. The guy shows up Tuesday, and it's a workman's comp issued from a temporary service that morning. He said he would throw the guy out, and when his renewal came up 6 months later, he didn't throw him out.
Yeah. Well, I Bradley, it's
out there.
Yeah.
So what's happening?
I understand. It's and you know, you've got a problem, and it's a problem that is not unusual for business people around the country, and it's not just isolated to the building trades. But you know, the bottom line is when people aren't playing by the rules of the game, and they're using that to compete unfairly against you, I think you should use the rules of the game against them. I mean, you can flip that right back around and say, no, you have to be doing this. You have to be doing this. It's pretty straightforward. And I mean, I've never tried to turn anybody in for not paying workman's comp, but it can't be that complicated. It can't be that big a deal. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Talk radio for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
See, we live in a world of false pretense. If it don't make dollars, it don't make sense. My credit is a joke, the banks ain't lending. I ain't broke yet, but I'm showing up bending. Living in a world of false pretense. If it don't make dollars and it don't make sense. My credit is a joke and the banks ain't lending. Ain't broke yet, but I'm showing up bending.
Well, he ain't broke yet, but he's showing up bending.
Ain't broke yet, but I'm showing up bending.
Well, he ain't broke
and welcome back to the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 9 minutes before the hour. Over at Think Progress, they note, Iran and India are making nearly identical arguments to justify pushing ahead with their respective nuclear programs. Ahmadinejad says, they are trying to deny our right to develop nuclear power, but nobody can impose anything on the Iranian people. India's prime minister says, there is no scope for capping of our strategic nuclear program. It will be decided by the people, government and parliament and the country, and not by any outside power. But the neocons want us to take out Iran, but not India. I'm frankly more concerned about Pakistan. That's the one that, I'm very concerned about. Leonard in Seattle, Washington, you're live and on the air. Hey, what's up?
Hi there. Love your show. Daily dose of sanity for me, for sure.
Thank you.
You were talking about Katrina, and early on, about three weeks after Katrina hit, the White House put Karl Rove in charge of the reconstruction effort. And
there was a minor
outcry, and I never heard that he got pulled. Now, what better way to rebuild the South than not allow any poor black Democrats a place to live down there?
Yeah. So the political operative was put in charge. You're right. I remember when that happened, and then it just kind of dropped off the radar screen.
Yeah, and it totally did, and I can't find anything about that on Google. And so I would love if the listeners would kind of pitch in and do some research and get back on that.
Because, yeah, that would be a good one. Okay, well, thanks
now,
a lot.
Hold it. Another point, I watched Brian Williams, NBC News. If you watch the YouTube little piece that was run, they're talking about catching politicians doing stupid things, and right after they utter that line, they show a Ned Lamont picture, and it isn't even a an action of his.
Hmm.
It is an ad somebody else put together. I invite you to look at that, and it is a very direct manipulation. And
well, you'll recall what Brian Williams said when he took over for Tom Brokaw. He was asked about, you know, where he gets his news from, and he said that he considers it a patriotic duty to listen to Rush Limbaugh every day.
Oh, well, good. I didn't know that.
He's done that for years.
If you look at that piece, you will see that they have a quote saying, when we catch somebody doing something stupid, they should be shown. And immediately they cut to Ned.
Yeah, what a surprise.
And you should watch that piece. And we should all get on the line and hammer these people for it.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Larry.
Bye.
Appreciate the call. Bill in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Listen, I wanted to make reference to the David Horowitz's comments here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar with this guy. Here's a guy who embraced violence on the left in the 60s and 70s. Now he's embracing violence on the right. I mean,
I never considered him a legitimate member of the left, frankly.
But he, you know, they always make references to the Second World War thing with the bombing and all that stuff.
Yeah.
First of all, that was total war. Do we want to be involved in constant total war? I mean, that was starting to strain us in 1945. We were starting to have a tougher time with replacements and everything like that.
Well, it wasn't just us. We also had the Soviet Union on our side, which was, you know, another major world power.
Right, which was taking a bulk of the German army on.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, that really, you know, arguably the Soviet Union is the group that was most responsible for defeating Hitler.
Yeah, and we bombed the bejesus out of North Vietnam, and, you know, this idea that bombing breaks people's will has been around since, like, the First World War, and it's never worked. It usually hardens their will.
That's exactly right. Look at England during the Blitz.
And here you're dealing with a religious component. Now you have, the Ottoman Turks weren't able to break the Greeks from their Christian orthodoxy. The English Protestants weren't able to break the Irish from their Catholicism. Is the logical progression that you're talking about with Horowitz the Israeli settler concept of mass population displacements here? Or, you know, I mean, what do we're starting to talk like the Third Reich talk, not like reasonable democratic people, you know?
It really concerns me, and it really concerns me when I hear folks like Chris Matthews saying that, you know, they may be right. I mean,
how would we possibly occupy these areas and control them?
We can't, Bill. That's the bottom line. We just can't. It can't be done, and that's why these neocon suggestions are insane. They're just plain old flat out insane. Bill, thanks a lot for the call. Jimmy in Sacramento, California. Hey, Jimmy.
Hey, good morning. Or, yeah.
Whatever. We just have a few.
Well, I saw some parallels between, you know, it was about suicide bombing. I've seen some parallels about Japanese society and the formation of the special attack.
The kamikaze.
Yes.
Yeah, those were elite, well-educated, high society, not high society and high society, but high, you know, that was a high status thing. And
yes.
It was hard to get into the kamikazes, actually.
Yes, they had, you know, and there was like, they wouldn't accept married young men.
Yeah. It was a very high status thing to die for your country.
And there were things about obligation, you know, the Shinto and Confucian obligations to society.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a lot for the call, Jimmy, and for pointing that out. I appreciate it. Coming up in the next hour, Hong Tran is going to be with us. And I want to continue on this issue of, you know, what's going on in the Middle East? Why are we doing this? Why are we pursuing this? Why what does this have to do with the panic of 1857? Yeah, it's 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for our
rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 1857. Some argue that this was one of the things that led to the Civil War. New York branch of the Ohio Life Insurance and Trust Company went bankrupt. And this started what is referred to as the Panic of 1857. Now, the America was in the middle of a boom-bust, you know, thing, the speculation, the railroad, real estates, things. There were all kinds of scams going on, phony businesses, pyramid scheme, all kinds of stuff that was causing booms and busts and attempts to monopolize the farm market, particularly in the areas where the railroads went through. People would go in and create essentially trusts and try and squeeze out small farmers. And this is, you know, the Grange came about in part by independent farmers trying to fight back against this kind of stuff, particularly the railroads. But this was a bad one. 4,923 companies, businesses, closed in the Panic of 1857. And that was a big deal back then. And for 2 years, I mean, people took to the streets. People were starving. This, of course, this was the tail end of the first American middle class. And this was now we were fully in the grip of laissez-faire, unbridled, raw capitalism. And that's what it brought us. And I would submit to you that that's what the Bushies, that's what the cons want to bring us again. And part of the process involves bankrupting America. And just taking us out, just running us so badly into debt that we can't do anything other than service the debt. And, I mean, they're aggressively working at that right now, the Bush administration. Every child born today is born with a $28,377.81 debt. Our national debt right now, $8.5 trillion. Specifically, $8,500,747,230,164.50. Whoop, it just went up another 100,000. Just went up another 200. Yeah. Family of four in America? $113,511 in debt. That's on your behalf. That's not our personal debt. That's the debt of the nation. That's how badly the Bushies have run us into debt. And now we've got this war going on, this war in Iraq that is tremendously enriching the cronies of the Bushies. I mean, gee, what a surprise, right? What a surprise! $398,400 has been spent so far in Iraq. That would be enough to pay for 40,900,000 kids to attend a year of Head Start, for example. Perhaps more to the point, that would be enough to pay for 14,993,000, basically 15 million full four-year scholarships at public universities for Americans. With the cost of the war in Iraq, we could have put 15 million American young people through full four years at a public university. We're not talking the local community college. Universities. 15 million. 4 year scholarships. I mean, it's absolutely mind-boggling when you think of it in that context. We could have hired an additional 5,359,852 teachers for our public schools with the money that we've spent on Iraq so far. You know, see some of these horrifying numbers, go over to costofwar.com. And at the same time, last year was the first year that Americans actually had a negative How do you say it? It's negative. No, it's not negative. It's, last year was the first year in the history of the United States that Americans spent more money than they brought in. The American family. We actually went in deeper in debt for the first time in the history of the United States. As far as I can tell, I'm surprised that there, you know, there wasn't a time during the Great Depression when this happened, but apparently debt was not that available. People just starved. And now we see this stir, and this is what, you know, wakes me up in the middle of the night. In the last 12 months, sales of existing homes have fallen 4.1%. Median price of homes in the West dropped 0.3%. In the Midwest, dropped 0.6%. In the Northeast, they've dropped 2.1%. This is from today's Wall Street Journal. The value of our housing stock is going down. Now, the South, they've gone up 3.2%. So the median price in the United States for the last year is up 0.9%, but inflation was more than that. So the actual value of our homes is dropping. Now, under ordinary circumstances, that wouldn't be that big a deal, except for the fact that Alan Greenspan and George W. Bush ran this con game on us for a couple of years to try and get the Republicans elected in 2002 and Bush elected in 2004 by driving down interest rates into the negative range. I mean, interest rates were below inflation rates for a little while there. And because people consider the amount of house they can buy to be a function of their monthly payments, not what the house costs, as the monthly payments dropped because the interest rates were dropping, people bought more and more expensive houses with the same amount of income. And perhaps more ominously, people all across the United States whose housing values were going up, they were watching the house that they paid $100,000 for, now it's worth $130,000. The house they paid $200,000 for is now worth $250,000. It's a, you know, in some places, the house they paid $300,000 for is now worth $1,000,000. I mean, it's that kind of, these kind of wild appreciations around the United States. They turned their houses into ATM machines. They were taking money out of their homes. And the mortgage companies just, you know, throwing money left and right. People, I know people who are getting mortgages that you know, interest only mortgages where that you're building no equity whatsoever, and they didn't have to put any down payment down. So what happens if you buy a $100,000 home and you get a $100,000 mortgage and the values start to drop and suddenly your home is only worth $90,000? If you're going to sell it, you're only going to get $85,000 for it because you got to pay a real estate commission, or less than that. So what happened? People walk away from them. I saw this happen back in the 70s, in the recession of the 70s, which was the consequence of a very similar process. You had Nixon and his war in Vietnam, and LBJ with the Great Society in the war in Vietnam. Domestic spending combined with war, financed by borrowing. And it came home to roost, by and large, on Jimmy Carter. It was a tough time. And it's just what spooks me is the possibility of this turning into a snowball going downhill. Andrew Tobias, the noted author on money, he's written a number of books about, you know, handling your money, managing your money, personal money, stuff like that. Over at his website, andrewtobias.com. He's got this housing note. He says, according to Grant's Interest Rate Observer, which credited Yale University economist Robert Schuller for this information, U.S. residential real estate prices rose in real terms after inflation by 66% from 1890 to 2004. That from that period of time, that you're looking at almost 100 years there. 0.4% a year. That's been the average. But between 1997 and 2005, this is when Greenspan was driving down interest rates, housing values went up 6.2% a year instead of 0.4% a year. This is a huge difference. He says if you return to the post-1968 trend lines, that would imply a drop of 22%. In other words, if things kind of go back to normal in the housing market, the value of housing in the United States is going to drop 22%. And he says this would be a disaster. He says, which, of course, for these real estate-centric United States would imply disaster. So you combine the massive debt that the Bush administration and Reagan, the two of them by and large, ran up for the United States, with the debt that Americans have, and we're in a precarious situation. We need some competent management in this country. And we're not getting it out of the Republican Party, and we're not getting it out of the DLC faction of the Democratic Party. We need to get progressives into office who will pay attention to this issue. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Burning up the atmosphere and cutting down the trees. The billion-dollar bombing of a nation on his knees. Anyone not marching to their tune, they call it treason. Everyone says God is on his side. See the lightning, hear the cries of the wounded in a world in holy war. Mortal thunder from the skies, killing everything they say they're fighting for.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Hong Tran is on the line with us. She's running in the Democratic primary against Maria Cantwell for the U.S. Senate in Washington State. And Hong Tran, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be back.
Your website, her website, Hong Tran, HongTran.com. Hong Tran, I think one of the most interesting things about you, aside from your positions on the issues, which we'll get to in just a second, is your personal story. The song we were just hearing about the bombing in times of war. You left Vietnam at the age of 8 at the end of the Vietnam War.
Yes, I did. I mean, as you said, I came to this country as a refugee of the Vietnam War, and so I'm very passionate about getting our troops out of Vietnam because I personally know the horror.
You're out of Iraq.
Oh, I'm sorry, out of Iraq, because I personally know the horrors that are visited upon the innocent civilians that are, you know, largely the victims of these unjust wars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not to mention the price that's paid ultimately by the soldiers as well, particularly
absolutely
when they come home. The issues in this election, what do you see as the real issues that are facing Washington State? And if you were elected to be the Democratic nominee for the U.S. Senate, what would you be campaigning on?
Well, as some of your listeners may know, I spent my last 14 years of my career as a legal aid attorney fighting for such things as affordable housing, health care, a better public education system, and government accountability on such issues as civil and human rights enforcement. And the Iraq war is central to the problems that are facing these programs, because the money that would otherwise have been invested in, you know, building a better healthcare system, invested in our public education system, and on alternative fuels, as Marie Cantwell is advocating, are being sent over to Iraq. And I believe that we need to end the occupation of Iraq so that we can end the bloodshed that is being done, you know, with at the hands of U.S. troops in many instances, unfortunately, and invest that energy and those resources into the domestic needs in this country, such as I mentioned, housing, healthcare, education, and the environmental needs of this country.
Hong Tran, what's your take? HongTran.com, the website, HongTran. What's your take on these international trade agreements, NAFTA, CAFTA? Now we have PAFTA or whatever coming up, the Peru Free Trade Agreement, and others.
Well, I'm very much opposed to these global trade agreements as they are negotiated and drafted, because they fail to include any protections for worker rights and environmental protections. And even, you know, this skimpy language that is included really is not strong enough to ensure that the workers in the countries of our trading partners, as well as the workers in this country, are protected from being exploited by these multinational corporations, who are really the only beneficiaries of these trade agreements.
Mm-hmm. You talk about our infrastructure in the United States, what would you do with the infrastructure of this country?
Well, as we all know from many news reports out of the LA Times, the Washington Post, the money that would have otherwise been invested, such as, you know, reinforcing the security at our ports, reinforcing our borders, ensuring that we have a strong emergency response system, have all been funneled to fight the war in Iraq. And, I mean, again, it was a completely unnecessary war. And the only reason that the Bush administration refuses to begin the withdrawal of U.S. troops is that they can't claim victory by doing so. And that is the only reason that we continue to remain in Iraq. And Democrats like Campbell,
it's face saving on the part. You mean it's face saving on the part of the Democrat or the Republican administration?
I'm sorry?
You mean it's face saving on the part of the Bush administration?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they feel like they can't get out and declare victory, so they're going to stay in for as long as it takes.
Yeah. Why can't they just declare victory and leave? I mean, to paraphrase, I think it was, I forget which senator it was back during Vietnam, but one of them had suggested that to Nixon.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure. I think that they're sort of mired in this view that if they don't leave the country in a stable condition, that they can't declare victory. But as we know, the violence in Iraq is just escalating. Just this last month was the deadliest month in this whole Iraq campaign. 3,500 Iraqi civilians died. And, you know, we were aghast when 3,000 civilians died in 9/11 and 3,500 died in 1 month in Iraq. Where is the outrage in that in this country? We have to end the bloodletting at the hands of U.S. troops, and we have to bring in a multinational peacekeeping force to work towards bringing peace and stability, and we need to hand over control of what's happening to the Iraqi government as opposed to allowing this administration to continue to call the shots in what's happening over there.
Well said. Hong Tran, running for the... In the state of Washington in the Democratic primary against Maria Cantwell. Her website, HongTran, HongTran.com. Hong Tran, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Great speaking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where being progressive never felt so good.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Get out there, get active, get involved while you still can. Before George Bush declares some state of emergency and suspends elections altogether. We've got to get active, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio. On this day in history, in 1814, British troops set fire to the White House. Yes, the White House. James Madison left on August 22nd and said to his wife, Dolly Madison, he was the president, that he's asked her if she had the courage or firmness to wait for his return. And then they arranged a secret place where they could meet should the British return before he did. And the next day, today, on this day in history, or actually it was yesterday, she saw the British coming. And she left behind their personal belongings and instead saved a full-length portrait of George Washington and fled through the night and met her husband in the middle of a thunderstorm at this predetermined place. And they never moved back into the White House because the British then occupied it today, ate the food in the White House, and then set the building on fire. And this was in 1814. It wasn't until 1817, 3 years later, during the term of President James Monroe, that the president moved back into the White House. James Madison spent the rest of his presidency in a building called the Octagon House in Washington, D.C. And in the midst of that, in the midst of the White House being attacked and burned, James Madison didn't think it necessary to suspend the Fourth Amendment. and spy on people without a warrant. He didn't think it necessary to suspend the First Amendment and have free speech zones and prevent people from being around him and hearing him speak. He didn't feel it necessary to suspend the Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, Seventh Amendment, Eighth Amendment, and put people in prison without charges, without an opportunity to have a trial by jury, and without an opportunity to see face their accusers and know what they were charged with. We have come a long, long way. By the way, we invited Maria Cantwell to come on the program, and we have not heard back from her office. So, as by way of fairness, but you know, let's check into what's going on with the occupation of Iraq, and then we'll get to your phone calls.
I wanna know who the men in the shadows are. I wanna hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones. To fight and to die, and there are lights in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the camp. And there is blood on the wire.
Following our security and other developments in Iraq, reported on Thursday as of 07:30 GMT, Dateline Baghdad, a U.S. soldier was killed on Wednesday after his unit clashed with militants south of Baghdad. Two insurgents were killed in that fighting. In Mosul, a hospital received the bodies of seven people with gunshot wounds, five from the same family. In Balad, gunmen killed three policemen at a checkpoint in that city. In Baghdad, police found the bodies of three people handcuffed and with gunshot wounds. In Suwaira, police found a body handcuffed and with gunshot wounds. In Baghdad, two policemen were wounded when a roadside bomb went off near their patrol. Near Latifia, police retrieved a body handcuffed, blindfolded, and with gunshot wounds. In Tikrit, police retrieved a body from the Tigris River. In Baiji, police found the body of an Iraqi near that town with his severed head. In Baqaba, three policemen and three civilians were wounded when a roadside bomb exploded near a police patrol. Also in Baqaba, a citizen was wounded when a roadside bomb went off near a shop selling alcohol in that city. Meanwhile, the Iraq war is debilitating the U.S. Marine Corps. As Max Bergman reports over at thinkprogress.org, the president has called up 2,500 inactive Marine reservists for involuntary duty to make up for manpower shortage. Even though many Marines have already served three tours in Iraq, the Marine Corps came up 1,200 volunteers short of its requirements. As defense commentator Fred Kagan of the conservative American Enterprise Institute put it bluntly, quote, "It is one of an avalanche of symptoms that the ground forces are overstretched by operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. This administration needs to understand this is not a short-term problem, and it really needs a systemic fix in the size of the ground forces." In addition to manpower shortages, the report released by the Center for American Progress shows that the Iraq war is increasingly taking its toll on the equipment of the Marine Corps. Vehicles like the Humvee and the M1A1 tanks, which are built to last for 15 years, they're burning out in 5 years or less. Cost to repair or replace, more than $5 billion a year. To make up for the equipment shortfalls, the Marines have been taking equipment from units outside of Iraq and from their strategic reserves. Now they're unable to train with equipment that they'll be using in combat, and so the readiness of the Marine Corps is suffering. And meanwhile, a new high has been reached among Americans in opposition to the Iraq war. 61% of Americans say they oppose the ongoing occupation of Iraq. Only 35% describe themselves as in favor of the war. So our ongoing mess, in Iraq. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Martha in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTT. Hey, Martha, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. It's really good to talk to you today.
Well, thank you for calling. What's up?
I have finally put it all together and figured it out in a way that makes sense. George Bush, as you know, is a dry drunk. He quit drinking and had the religious conversion, but never did the work required for real recovery.
Now, this all in the worldview of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And, you know, I think you find that in the psychological community also, there is a pretty clear view that with the addictive personality, what drives the addiction is their issues inside the person. That the substance that you pick up, really, that just becomes the ism. You know, it's whatever
you... That's the symptom, not the cause. Yeah.
Exactly.
So you're suggesting that Bush's problem, that our problem, is that we have as a president a dry drunk.
Well, it certainly sets up an understanding of why he does what he does in the way that he does. And, you know, I've done a lot of reading about the addictive personality and the treatment and that sort of thing. And, you know, some of the notorious characteristics of these people are an intolerance for nuance. The world has to be black or it has to be white. Anything in between is just intolerable.
Yeah, now that could be a symptom of that. That's also, you know, Carl Jung identified that as in his judgers and perceivers spectrum. He said that about 20% of people are judgers. They only see the world in black and white. About 80% of people are perceivers. They see shades of gray.
Yes.
You know, it had nothing to do with alcoholism. It's just a personality characteristic.
Exactly. You know, and it may be, if somebody wants to do the research, that you find out that the people with the judging type of a personality may be more prone to, you know, needing...
To addictions.
Yeah.
Yeah, it may be.
To fix that with
Martha, I have to move along, but your observation is one that many people have been making for a number of years, and I can't fault it. So, thank you for calling and sharing it with us.
Yes, it was good to talk to you, Tom.
Yeah, thank you very much, Martha. Estelle in Pittsburgh. Hey, it's Pittsburgh Day. Hey, Estelle.
Hello,
Estelle. You're live and on the air.
Well, thank you, Tom. I think I should say Professor Hartman. I have really enjoyed your program.
Thank you very much.
Now, I want you to think about a section of the country where crab is king. And I'm talking about Maryland, of course, mm-hmm. and Chesapeake Bay.
Yep.
And, you know, you were talking about housing and how our values have changed in this country. Recently, there was an article in our food section in our local Pittsburgh Post-Gazette by one of their very good food authors. She's made a trip to Maryland to eat crab, and I sit and dream when I read these articles. But then she talks about areas in her article where you can go and actually eat these, and as she says, in these towns, there are no fast food franchises. So she's talking first about the town of St. Michael's. And this ties into your War of 1812 history. St. Michael's, it seems, was a shipbuilding center by the War of 1812.
Mm-hmm.
And it earns it nickname the town that fooled the British. When the Brits aimed to blast it with cannonballs, they were foiled when the residents hoisted lanterns up into the trees to fool the enemy into shooting over the town's houses. One house took a ball in the attic. So this, she calls this town a typical poster child for small town USA.
Mm-hmm.
And keeps shops, boutique shops.
Pardon my interrupting you, but we have about 30 seconds before we have to
make a break. Okay,
the point being.
She said they usually stop at the Crab and Steak Bar in St. Michael's. And they learned the biggest thing to happen to St. Michael's lately, the recent arrival of two weekend residents. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld purchased the former waterfront B&B for $1.5
million.
Oh. Not to be outdone, his buddy Dick Cheney bought a waterfront Cape Cod nearby for $2.6
million. Hmm.
Now, doesn't that make the cockles of your heart warmer?
I guess so, Estelle. Thank you very much for the call. It's certainly, that's an interesting story. I'm not sure what to make of it. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. So, oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz. Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Dialing $4 is trying to find me. I wait for delivery each day until 3. So, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? I'm counting on you, Lord. Please don't let me down.
Well, Janice, I don't know. If my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War on the Middle Class, is out, and it's looking over here at Amazon.com, somebody reviewed it negatively, saying, come on, a middle class? He says, that time was unique in human history, talking about the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. He says, the world is caught up in terms of trained workers and infrastructure. This is tragic. He says, supply and demand, here, for a brief 10 to 20 year period, this was the reality dictated by the world labor market, but no longer and never again. American workers must compete against a larger labor pool. Supply and demand dictates that they must earn less. No, I'm sorry, I don't buy it. This is the Thomas Friedman worldview, and it's, somebody, going off after my book just on Amazon.com, and I just don't buy it. I'm sorry. We can have a middle class in the United States, and a strong one. It's what is bringing about this, we all have to compete with everybody else in the world, even if they're only willing to make 30 cents an hour, is the worldview of multi-billionaire Thomas Friedman and his multinational friends, and they are wrong. We can have a middle class in the United States. We've done it before. We can do it again. 1-866-440-8466. Dave in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, one thing I wanted to mention to you on the this home loan situation, the housing bubble and the refis, is this is going to be different this time than it's ever been before. We've got a couple of things going for us now, or going, not going against us. You've got the bankruptcy change.
Right. The bankruptcy bill is going to make it much harder for people to walk away from their house.
And there's also, here in California and many other states, a lot of these people gave up the protection they had under the under homestead rules, et cetera, when they gave up their first loan and refied. And the banks now can just change the type of foreclosure, go after a legal foreclosure, and saddle these folks with the difference between what the house sells for and what they owe.
Yeah, I don't know if it's still in a provision, but I remember 20 years ago signing a mortgage document and actually reading the thing. And there was a paragraph in it that said, I hereby acknowledge that I'm giving up my rights under the, and there were two amendments to the Constitution under like the 13th and 17th Amendment, whatever it was, I don't remember what they were, under these two amendments to the Constitution. And then there was another place in there where it said, at any time with 90 days notice, the bank can call the note, you know, can simply say, okay, you have to pay the whole thing, or you're in default. And I was horrified. I said, you know, I can't sign this. This is crazy. And the banker said, you know, this is just boilerplate. You sign it or you don't get the mortgage.
A lot of people don't realize they gave up that protection when they got a refi to buy a BMW, a boat, or a motorcycle, what have you.
Yeah.
But this works very much in favor for the corporations.
Oh, yeah. The banking industry is loving this stuff.
Greenspan had warned us for over a year and a half about the coming labor shortage when the baby boomers retired. And we're not talking about people that turn nuts. We're talking about key executives, rainmakers, top salespeople that are expected to retire for over a 10-year period. Now, they can solve this easily when these folks are in debt expecting to sell a house to retire.
And now they can no longer do it.
They can no longer do it, and they're going to be 40.
So we'll just have people work until they're 70 instead of 60.
Absolutely. I think this is somewhat intentional by those folks with the hands and levers on the economy.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all, Dave. Dave, thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear from you. James in Seattle, Washington. Hey, James.
Tom, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it. My wife, Barb, is driving me to the airport right now. I'm an airline pilot, and as you're probably aware, we may be days away from a strike by the Northwest flight attendants.
Yes, I understand that they may even be random strikes. Is that what they're talking about doing?
Well, I'm not really sure what the conditions of the strike will be, but one of the things that's afoot right now is an attempt to get an injunction to prevent these flight attendants from going on strike.
Mm-hmm.
And it's huge for labor,
One of the things that you might know is that a lot of the pilots that I fly with are very much leaning to the right. And I think they need to pay attention to what's going to happen next and what this administration has done for the labor movement in general.
You mean to it?
I just, what's your opinion on the possibility of a legal prevention of our, you know, constitutional right to strike?
It wouldn't surprise me if the Bush administration was to invoke something like that, was to declare that the airline industry was an essential industry, and therefore they could prevent, or they could, you know, force a cooling down period, or even worse, they could decertify the union. Wouldn't surprise me at all. They would love to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, this is a huge thing, and the ramifications for labor in general. Right now, everybody that's a flight attendant, a pilot, or just an airline employee in general needs to pay real close attention to what's going to happen in the next couple of days.
Do you know if there's a website for the Flight Attendants Union where people could go to support the flight attendants who may be striking at Northwest?
You know, I don't know what the website is. I'm actually a pilot for another airline, but we've got a very good friend who's basically looking right down the jaws of the lion right now.
Yeah, well, I'll have to check into that, and I'll get back with folks on that tomorrow. James, thanks for the heads up. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Tom.
Keep spreading the good word.
Call.
Good to hear from you. Coming up tomorrow, Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. He'll be taking your calls, and John Zogby is going to be dropping by with the latest breaking poll information. That and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program. And remember, my friends, always remember, get out there, get active. Democracy, activism, it all begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.